some time, I could describe what I might write in my memoir someday about some other experiences that I had with book publishing in the MIT Press, which I think Long knows about. For the people of Indochina, the issue of crucial significance is what happened to them to these ravaged countries during one of the worst, if not the worst, war crime of the post-Second World War era, horrendous assault upon a civilian population, primarily South Vietnam, as Long pointed out. For the world, what's of crucial significance is how these crimes are interpreted in the aggressor state, namely us. That question, in part, is pretty easy to answer for intellectual elites in the United States, for the communities in which we live. It's pretty easy to determine. There's a huge published record. And there's a certain spectrum. I won't talk about the right wing. Much more interesting is the dissident extreme that is permitted within the mainstream. So there's no one more extreme than Anthony Lewis in the New York Times. At the end of the war in 1975, he wrote a retrospective in which he said that the war began with benign intentions, but with blundering efforts to do good. That's how it began. But by 19, the kind of thing that Long was just describing, but by 1969, it had become clear that it was a mistake that was too costly for us. That's the extreme end. Why 1969? Well, because that was about a year and a half after the business community in the United States had turned against the war, partly because they regarded it as too costly to the United States, and partly because they recognized what I think is true, that the basic war, that the U.S. had basically won the war in terms of its major war aims, so there wasn't any point going on. 1960, we do also know something about public opinion. So, for example, in 1969, when the extreme dissident end was able to conceive that the blundering efforts to do good may have become too costly to us. In 1969, about 70% of the population of the United States regarded the war as, the words of the polls, not a mistake, but fundamentally wrong and immoral. If you want to do the numbers, which incidentally are sustained up until the most recent polls just a few years ago, roughly 70%. You might do a research project to see if any words like that, fundamentally wrong and immoral, not a mistake, appear anywhere within anything like mainstream literature, press, scholarship, virtually anything. But it does happen to be the opinion of the vast majority of the population, and the numbers are pretty striking because these are people who've never heard it. Those results are never reported. Presumably everyone thinks I'm the only crazy person who thinks this. And it's important that results not be reported so that people will feel isolated and helpless and so on. Why did the business press believe that the war had basically been won by 1969? It's an unusual view. The usual story is the U.S. lost. In fact, that's supposed to be a terrible loss. Well, whether the U.S. won or lost depends on which war aims you're looking at. There were maximal aims and there were basic aims. The maximal aims were to turn Indochina into actually what was described as the model, described openly as the model, namely Indonesia after 1965. In Indonesia in 1965, U.S.-backed, partly instigated military coup led by General Suharto, killed about maybe a million people, mostly landless peasants, wiped out the only mass-based political party in the country, instituted a regime of torture and oppression and violence. It was called by the CIA one of the worst mass murders of the 20th century. They compared it to Hitler and Stalin. It wasn't concealed here. The New York Times described it as a staggering bloodbath, which was a gleaming light in Asia, because the independent, the main party of the poor was totally wiped out, and the country was opened up to Western exploitation. So that was the model. And it's true that the United States did not succeed in imposing that model on Indochina. So in that respect, it was a failure, and the U.S. lost the war, couldn't create an Indonesia. On the other hand, if you look at the major war aims, that wasn't what it was at all. This is incidentally a case where Vietnam is quite different from Iraq. In Vietnam, the U.S. had no particular interest in maintaining control over Vietnam, quite unlike Iraq. The goal in Vietnam, the basic war aim in Vietnam, was to destroy the country, and for good, rational reasons, which they explained in places like Harvard and MIT. The problem was that they were concerned that an independent Vietnam might undertake a course of development that would become a kind of a model that others in the region would want to follow. It's what's called in internal documents a virus that might infect others. And when you have a virus that might infect others, you have to destroy the virus and inoculate the others. And that what was done, the virus was destroyed, never going to be a model to anybody. And the potential victims were inoculated, like in Indonesia with the staggering mass slaughter that was a gleaming light in Asia. And the same in surrounding countries, Marcos in the Philippines and so on. And the concern about the spread of the infection was very deep. So George Kennan, for example, was afraid that, when he was one of the top planners, that infection in Indonesia might spread throughout all of South Asia, even threatening the U.S. position in the Middle East, a crucial area where the world's energy is. And it was feared that the Vietnamese virus might extend as far as Indonesia. And if that happened, Japan, it was John Dower here described Japan as the super domino. Japan might have to accommodate to the Asian mainland, becoming its industrial and technological center in an independent area. And that would, in effect, recreate what Japan was trying to achieve during World War II, they called the co-prosperity sphere, which would mean that the United States would have lost the Second World War. And the United States government was not prepared in the late 1940s to lose the Second World War. And Vietnam, as John F. Kennedy put it, was the keystone in the arch. I mean, if that one fell, as it was called, that is, moved towards independence, the rot would spread, the virus would infect others, and you could have, you know, it could turn out to be terrible. Kennan, incidentally, had no objection to restoring to Japan what he called its empire toward the south, that is, its co-prosperity sphere, and the United States, in fact, did that, but this time it was under U.S. control, so it was okay. That's why Kennan supported reconstructing the Japanese world order, but of course under U.S. control. And Vietnam was regarded as a keystone of the arch for that. Well, you know, by 1968, it was pretty clear to anyone with eyes open that Vietnam would be lucky to survive. It wasn't going to be a model for anyone. The virus was destroyed. The region had been inoculated. So the war became, as McGeorge Bundy later said, former Harvard dean who was national security advisor for Kennedy, he said, after 1965, with the mass slaughter, staggering mass slaughter in Indonesia, he said the U.S. war in Indochina became excessive. In other words, costing us too much. So it was kind of like a bad tactical decision to keep going after the basic war aims had been won. That's the core of the issue, I think, and that's why business turned against the war had by 1968, and a year or two later, at the extreme left of intellectual opinion, you were allowed to call the war a mistake that began with blundering efforts to do good. Well, the idea that's in the heads of the population that it was fundamentally wrong and immoral and not a mistake, that has to be driven from their minds, clearly. And there have been huge efforts to do that ever since, with kind of mixed effects. The polls remain more or less the same. On the other hand, there has been an effect. So, for example, knowledge of the war is extraordinary in the United States. There was actually only been one major academic study, as far as I know, of what people believe about the war, and it's mind-boggling. A couple of years ago, they found that people were asked to give an estimate of the number of Vietnamese who died during the war, and the mean estimate was 100,000, which is about 5% of the official U.S. figure and probably 2 or 3% of the actual figure. The authors of the study point out that it's as if you took a poll in Germany and asked people how many Jews died in the Holocaust, and the mean judgment was 300,000, in which case we'd think that there's a slight problem in Germany. But here, it's kept from us. We're not supposed to think about it. The results are even worse because it turns out that this poll was taken in a leading Northeastern university, which is pretty politically active for the general population, might be even crazier. Right before the November election last year, I happened to be away and, you know, trying to find out what was going on in the world and in a hotel, so I turned on television, something I usually try to avoid. But I got an interesting program. There was a program, I think it was on CNN or something, an hour-long serious discussion led by the chief media critic of the Washington Post, Howard Kurtz, with lots of deep thinkers. And the program was called America's Vietnam Obsession. And it was about the strange obsession of the United States with Vietnam after all these years. What they were talking about is, you know, did Kerry deserve the Bronze Medal and all that kind of stuff. Well, what the program demonstrated is that America's Vietnam obsession, at least among liberal elite opinion, is zero. There's only one question that arises about Kerry in Vietnam, and that is, what was he doing in 1969 deep in the Mekong Delta, seven which had been practically devastated, killing South Vietnamese, 7 years after John F. Kennedy had launched an outright war against South Vietnam, focused on places like the Mekong Delta, and 15 years after the United States had instituted a Latin American-style terror state in South Vietnam, which, as Long just mentioned, had killed 70,000 people in the Mekong Delta alone. Well, whatever happened in the whole country. So what was Kerry doing there 15 years after this? Right in the midst, in 1969, which incidentally happened to be the peak period of U.S. atrocities in South Vietnam. That was the post-Tet accelerated pacification campaign, which was carrying out extraordinary atrocities, of which one became famous, My Lai, which became famous because you could blame it on poor, uneducated, half-crazed GIs in the field who didn't know who was shooting at them next and did commit an atrocity. But as it happened, that was a minor footnote to a major mass murder campaign, Operation Wheeler Wallawa, which was organized by nice guys like us and sitting in air-conditioned offices who were plotting B-52 raids on villages and, you know, killing who knows how many tens of thousands of people. So therefore, they're immune because they're our kind. But My Lai was those guys, so you're allowed to be angry about it. In fact, there was a Quaker clinic in Quang Nai province working right where My Lai was. They knew about the atrocity immediately, but they didn't even bother reporting it because it was happening every day. okay, what's the big deal? Here's just another one. Those are the real stories, but not the ones we know. Anyway, that's the question. Those are the kind of questions that would arise if there was even concern, let alone obsession, about what actually happened in Vietnam among liberal intellectual elites, but there isn't. The 1962, when Kennedy escalated from a Latin American-style terror state, which had killed who knows how many tens of thousands of people, escalated to an outright war, 1962 was the year when the U.S. Air Force, when Kennedy sent the U.S. Air Force to start bombing South Vietnam, authorized the use of napalm, initiated the use of chemical warfare to destroy food crops so as to drive the population into the concentration camps, which had been given various names, ultimately many millions of them. Story was that they had to be protected behind barbed wire from the South Vietnamese resistance, which they were willingly supporting. And it was there was no controversy over the fact that they were willingly supporting them. That was understood. It was recognized on all sides. You look at the internal documents and so on, they agreed that it was a political war against a military war. The South Vietnamese had political strength and the U.S. had military strength, so therefore the U.S. naturally shifted the war to the arena in which they could prevail, military strength, which is why the atrocities took place. The South Vietnamese who were the victims of the war were labeled aggressors, or as some put it, Adlai Stevenson, a liberal hero, Kennedy's ambassador to the UN, called it internal aggression. Interesting new concept. It was an assault from within, according to John F. Kennedy. And the terminology was made some sense. The technical definition of aggression in U.S. Army manuals included as one type of aggression political warfare. That's one type of aggression. So yes, they were indeed the aggressors in their own country, and we were defending ourselves by slaughtering them. And the U.S. was entirely aware of this. So Kennedy's ambassador in South Vietnam, Henry Cabot Lodge, was cabling back that the generals are all we've got. We've lost everybody else. But there's a problem with the generals, he said. They have not been able to construct an efficient police state like Hitler's Germany. So therefore, we've got some problems. We've got to get over this and let them do it. Well, return to the reshaping of history. After the war, when you have to start reconstructing it the right way in people's minds, we get to, say, President Carter, 1977, who gave his view of the war. This, again, is at the kind of liberal extreme. He said, we owe Vietnam no debt because the destruction was mutual. You want to see how mutual it was? Take a walk in Plains, Georgia, and the Mekong Delta, and you'll see. What was interesting about that comment is that it received no reaction. Nobody was appalled. Yeah, okay. Destruction was mutual, so we don't owe them any debt. By the time you get to Bush number one, there's a much harder line. There is a debt. It's theirs. They're the ones who are guilty. The destruction was not mutual. It took place here in Texas. But he said, we're nice guys. So in his words, we seek only answers without the threat of retribution for the past. In other words, we're willing to forget all the crimes that you committed against us, and we only seek answers because we're such nice guys. Now, what are the answers? Well, the answers are to the one moral issue that remains after destroying South Vietnam, namely the missing in action, who were somehow shot down over Iowa, by some strange way. But as long as that gets answers, everything's fine. We don't need any answers about the millions of corpses in South Vietnam or about the hundreds of thousands of victims of chemical warfare, which we have recently learned, though it doesn't get reported, was at about twice the intensity of what was reported during the war, and according to U.S. analysts, left about 2.1 million victims. We don't have to need answers for the deformed fetuses in Saigon hospitals and the people who are still dying, including people who born after, years after the chemical warfare officially stopped, but are still contracting serious diseases, cancer, and mutilation, and so on. But we don't have to ask about that. And in fact, it almost never gets reported. Actually, sometimes it does, to be fair. There was an article in the science section of the New York Times a couple of years ago that suggested that it's really not a good idea to ignore this. We should study it. And the reason we should study it is there's a good, it's an unusually good experimental situation because we have a control group. It's only South Vietnam that was subjected to this particular war crime, not North Vietnam, but to have the same genes. So we can study the effects of incredibly high concentrations of dioxin, one of the most worst carcinogens known. We can study the effects of this on humans by comparing the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese, and maybe we could learn something from that that would be useful for us. So really, it might be a good idea to look for answers. We go on a couple of years, and we get to Robert McNamara's memoirs 10 years ago, in retrospect. The reaction to the book was, I won't talk about the book, but the reaction to it was extremely interesting. The Hawks condemned McNamara for treachery. The Doves applauded him because they were vindicated. And this includes, you know, the real people way out at the edge. I mean, the religious leaders who were opposing the war on moral grounds. They were vindicated. Why? Because McNamara issued an apology, which is true. He issued an apology to Americans, not the Vietnamese, not a word about that. He issued an apology to Americans for not telling them early enough that the war was probably going to be too costly to Americans. So the Doves are vindicated. Well, you know, tells you something. In McNamara's retrospect, he does, it's mostly U.S. government sources, but he quotes one outside expert. That's a good choice. It's Bernard Fall, who incidentally was an extreme hawk, but an unusual, and a military historian and a Vietnamese specialist and knew a lot about the country, in fact was killed there. So it was a good choice. He was unusual among Vietnamese specialists in that he actually cared about the people, even though he was a super hawk. McNamara quotes him. He says that in 1965 is when the official war started. You know, U.S. started bombing North Vietnam and sent troops to the South. In 1965, McNamara says that, he refers to Bernard Fall, a great expert, and he said Fall was providing encouraging news, McNamara says, encouraging news which helped persuade Washington that the U.S. effort could not fail. So that was really good news. What did Fall actually say? What he said is, in 1965, he said what changed the character of the war was not the bombing of North Vietnam, not the sending of U.S. soldiers to the South, but the decision to escalate to unlimited aerial warfare against South Vietnam at the price of literally pounding the place to bits. That was the encouraging news, because he added, well, in the short run, the U.S. probably can't lose. So Washington was very encouraged. The Washington liberals were very encouraged because Fall said they could not lose at the price of pounding the place to bits. McNamara goes on and says that in 1967, Fall reversed his stand and felt that U.S. power and technology might not prevail. Again, he doesn't quote him, but here's what he said. He said, Vietnam as a cultural and historic entity is threatened with extinction under the blows of the largest military machine ever unleashed against an area this size, and U.S. force might prevail, he felt, extinguishing the country. If you can try to figure out what goes on in someone's head who reports that sort of thing, I let me know about it. The operative values of the U.S. war are very well illustrated by comparison of the bombing of the South and the bombing of the North. The bombing of the South was vastly more intense and started years earlier. But if you look at the records, we now have a rich array of records from the Pentagon Papers and other internal sources and memoirs like McNamara's, and they're all the same. The bombing of the North was meticulously planned, you know, very careful thinking about should we go here, should we escalate a little, and so on and so forth, huge record. The bombing of the South is barely mentioned. There weren't any plans. You just do it, you know. Bomb the place to bits, extinguish the country. It's also true of the anti-war movement, unfortunately. Most of the protest was against the bombing of the North, which was a crime, hideous crime, but peripheral. I mean, the bombing of the South, the attack on the South, the counterinsurgency and the bombing and everything else, were far worse. Among the sort of in the establishment, a protest was almost entirely against the bombing of the North. Bombing of the South was barely mentioned. Well, what's the difference between them? Unfortunately, it's regrettably easy to answer, to give the explanation. The bombing of the South was costless to the United States. The population was totally defenseless. So you could bomb them as much as you want. Do you want to drive the country to extinction? Not going to cost you anything. And there was not very much international protest because the West accepts the moral principles of Western imperialism. After all, it's been going on for hundreds of years. If you want to destroy defenseless people, that's your right. On the other hand, the bombing of the North was dangerous for the United States. If you're bombing the North, you might be hitting Russian ships in the Haiphong Harbor or an internal Chinese railroad, which happens to pass through North Vietnam. And there are embassies in Hanoi, which might not be happy about it, Western embassies, and so on. So bombing of the North carried a certain risk for the United States, and therefore was meticulously planned. But bombing of the South, being completely costless, is scarcely even mentioned. Well, unfortunately, that's easy to talk about and explain. And the same is true of the very rare cases like My Lai, where atrocities are acknowledged, as long as you can blame them on somebody else, not like us. You'll notice that the same is going on in Iraq. What happened at Abu Ghraib, for example, is criminal, but it's much easier to blame it on, whatever her name is, England, some uneducated person who's sort of forced into the army, but because it's a mercenary army, the poor, and to absolve, say, Donald Rumsfeld or George Tenet or George Bush, who are the people who are responsible. Actually, Human Rights Watch just put out a report on that, which won't be reported, I'm sure. Same in, say, Fallujah. There were reports about atrocities in Fallujah. One Marine killed somebody who was apparently wounded or not resisting. That became a big atrocity. What about the turning Fallujah into Grozny, you know, just smashing the city to dust? Well, that's not an atrocity. What about capturing the general hospital the first day and forcing the patients to lie on the floor, taking them out of bed, forcing them to lie on the floor, hands manacled behind their back, under guard? That wasn't a secret. There's a big front page picture in the New York Times about it. I mean, that is a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions, and George Bush, in fact, is subject to the death penalty for that under U.S. law, under the U.S. War Crimes Act. That's literally true. The U.S. War Crimes Act of 1996, passed by a Republican Congress, makes grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions crime punishable by death. Actually, that's part of the reason, I presume, why Bush's legal counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, now Attorney General, advised him to rescind the Geneva Conventions because he said it would reduce the likelihood of punishment. Well, not bad advice. Okay, I'm barely skimming the surface, and I'll stop here. But the general point is that we're not talking about some exotic tribe we don't understand. We're talking about ourselves, you know, the most important topic, the one we're supposed to understand best, and the one that's certainly most important to us. And unless people like us become capable of looking in the mirror honestly, the biology's only experiment with higher intelligence is likely to prove quite brief.